Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to go ahead and pray, and then we'll jump into Joshua chapter 10. We've got a lot of ground to cover tonight. I've got some maps that we'll review and take a look at and see how this all comes together. Father, we come to you tonight in the name of Jesus. We do thank you again for the opportunity to look into your word. We thank you for the scriptures that are before us. We ask again that we look at these things accurately, that you'd inspire us, that you'd give us again the strength that we need to grow in our faith, to become the people you want us to be at this time in history. We thank you for recording it for us. And Father, we also thank you for the confirmation that we see in archaeology and in historical other historical records that bring this to light and make us realize that we're not just following a fantasy, Father, but we're following truth and your movement through history. Again, we thank you for the goodness and ask that we be part of the continuity of your work in history. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. What you look at here, I've handed you out a set of notes. There's several pages. What this takes you from is right here, chapter 9 and 10, and takes you to the end of the book of Joshua. What I'd like to do is, I'm not going to tell you what I'd like to do. Because if it doesn't work, you won't know it didn't work. But there's the whole rest of the book is here. But a lot of it is the dividing up of the land. So there are going to be chapters where it just reads off, this is the boundaries of Judah's territory. Well, I went through and marked them on here, and you can see where they are at. And so again, there's no sense. I don't want to say there's no sense reading it, but basically all it does is tell you where those markers are. There are some stories interlaced in the division of the land that we'll take a look at. But let's go ahead and look at the first map on that first page, and the first page is stapled in the upper right corner, I believe, and it's the Gibeonites deceive Joshua. Joshua conquers central Canaan. So it'd be Joshua chapter 9. And chapter 10, verses 1 through 28, taking us right up to where we left off last time. And that's where Joshua was at Gilgal. The Gibeonites, right there at the base of the high spot of Geba, the high place of Geba right here, the Gibeonites had come over and made a treaty with the Israelites. The Israelites signed it. They didn't read the fine print. Just like we've got to read the fine print. If we sign a contract and we don't read the whole thing, they say, it's in the contract. Well, Joshua's obligated, it appears, in their culture and before the Lord to honor the contract that they signed, even though a little bit of, phone calls or what would you call it, the phone calls that try and sell you stuff. I'll just say scams or something. They got scammed, but God says you signed it. Well, when they find out that Geba now is, or the Gibeonites are part of Israel's treaty, they're under their protection, but they're also under God's divine protection. And I referred to that last week, too, in the days of Samuel. In the days of Saul, Saul apparently tried to wipe out the Gibeonites from among the Israelites, and God brought judgment on Israel because they broke this treaty. And they didn't protect the Gibeonites like they had agreed to. Well, on that first map, what you see there is the little arrows coming out of Jerusalem, or the little arrows going towards Jerusalem. And I've got little crowns that look like little flowers or something, but this was me drawing with a pencil a long time ago. And those are kings that are mentioned as being kings by Israel. Now, the only king mentioned in the writing of the Egyptians in those letters, the Armana letters going back and forth, is Hazor. Hazor has a king that is recognized by Egypt in those letters. These others are kings recognized by the Canaanites and recognized by Israel, but those names don't pop up in the Armana letters as being kings. They're more like chieftains in those areas. But nonetheless, they're called kings in our text tonight. Jerusalem, Makeda, Lachish, Eglon, and Hebron all have kings, or it looks like little flowers here on our map. And they are called by Adonai Zedek to come to Jerusalem, and then they go off to attack the Gibeonites. And that's what that map is. And then on the next map, you see Joshua marching from Gilgal all night long, from Gilgal over this way and engaging in battle. And that's what we ended up with last. We can see him fleeing across the plain of Aijalon with Gezer over here and the plain of Aijalon, and they're heading kind of this way. And that's where the hailstones fall. That's where the sun stands still. And Joshua ends up defeating all of those kings, and those kings are then, they hide in a cave. They're covered up by a rock until the battle is over, and then they come back, and they're going to execute those kings. And just as you look at those cities there on that second map right there, I don't want to keep saying if you were in Israel, but, you did go to Israel. So if you see right there, it says Gezer right there. You were there. We looked at the plain, or drove on the plain of Aijalon. Lachish. We stopped at the base of Lachish and took some pictures. That's going to be destroyed in the days of Jeremiah by the Babylonians, one of the last great stands. And there's Gaza. And Ashkelon is just north of Gaza. We were talking about Gaza, the missiles coming over from Gaza just this recently, the last few weeks. That's the Gaza Strip right there. And then Hebron. I've never been to Hebron because you're too far, you're too deep into the West Bank. You're too far, and it's not safe to go down into Hebron, although there are some great things to see there. But anyway, that's kind of where we ended up last week. With the ending of what you see right there, the central campaign. You've had the entrance campaign, you've had the central campaign, and now if you turn to the next map, we're going to have the, I should say this. This is when they came down here, this was that southern campaign. They're now going to move north, and that's on that next map where it says, let's go to the text here, please. Joshua chapter 10, verse 29, and this is that southern campaign. I just want to read through this, and these are the cities that they go through. I know what I wanted to say. Just this route that runs the Beth Horon, the route that runs, you've come up from the coastal plain right here, then you hit the hill country, and you start climbing up the hills to Jerusalem. You'll land, if you fly to Israel, you'll land in Tel Aviv, and then you take a cab or some kind of a cheroute or something to Jerusalem. And it runs along that same, I don't think my lines are exactly right here, but you run along that same route. If armies would march from the north down the coastal plain and move in, or they come up from the south and move in, like the Babylonians or the Egyptians, they would take basically that same route that today is the main highway. And when we drive from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, it's the same route. You can see the different places that are marked there on the map, the ancient remains of different things there. Okay, so here we go. Chapter 10, verse 29. Then Joshua and all Israel with him moved out from Makeda to Libna and attacked it. And if you follow along then on your map there, you can see these places. The Lord also gave that city and its king into Israel's hand. The city and everyone in it, Joshua put to the sword. He left no survivors there, and he did it to its king as he had done to all the kings of Jericho, to the king of Jericho. Then Joshua and all Israel with him moved up from Libna, on from Libna to Lachish. And that's exactly, again, we've got a documentation where the Assyrians were fighting. There's Sennacherib. When he destroys Lachish, he's got murals on his wall at Nineveh that you can still see in museums that they carved the battle from 701 B.C. when he's fighting here at Lachish. Well, this is when Joshua's fighting at Lachish. There's a good chance that many of these cities were not walled, and that's why one of the advantages Joshua had is of moving through them very quickly, because they weren't walled at that time. The Lord handed Lachish over to Israel, and Joshua took it on the second day. It took him 2 days. The city and everyone in it he put to the sword, just as he had done to Libna. Meanwhile, Horam, the king of Gezer, and that's Gezer right here, Gezer is going to be taken by Israel, but it's going to also then go back to the Canaanites until Pharaoh comes up. And Pharaoh, during Solomon's day, is going to attack Gezer, burn it to the ground, and give it to his daughter as a part of her dowry gift. And that's when she marries Solomon, and that's when Gezer becomes Israel territory solidly. And that's when Solomon then goes in there and builds the gates. And we saw the gates that Solomon had built at Gezer. They match the gates of Gezer, match the gates of Megiddo, match the gates of Hazor. They're all made, and the scriptures record Solomon built gates at Gezer, Megiddo, and Hazor. And you can see when you get there and see them, they're the same design, the six-chamber gate that you can see there. Okay? But anyway, at this time right here, they attacked. The king from Gezer came down to attack. Verse 34, then Joshua and all Israel with him moved on from Lachish to Eglon. Then they took up positions against it, attacked it. They captured it the same day and put it to the sword and totally destroyed everyone in it, just as they had done to Lachish. Then Joshua and all Israel with him went up from Eglon to Hebron. Now we're heading down into Hebron here, Abram's hometown. And they took, not hometown, but one of the places he lived. They took the city and put it to the sword together with its kings. Now remember, what's at Hebron? That's where Abraham and Sarah are buried. That's where the cave of Machpelah is, where the patriarchs are buried. And it's still a monument today. There's Herodian stones going around it with a wall And there's the tomb is on the inside. So it was marked by Herod during his day where the tomb of the patriarchs were, because it had been remembered all along. So it's pretty clear that this wasn't found or marked by the Crusaders or somebody, you know, in the middle of the church age. It was marked by the Jews and honored by Herod. So it's a pretty definite place that this is the tomb. We know where the tomb of Abram is. And, of course, it was there at this time. Verse 37, they took the city and put it to the sword together with its kings, its villages, and everyone in it. They left no survivors, just as at Eglon. They totally destroyed it and everyone in it. Now, they would be, you know, it doesn't say here, but I'm assuming they're taking plunder from these places. Places like Jericho, they had to burn it and leave everything there. It was harem, a total destruction. But these other places, God had promised, you'll destroy it, but you'll keep the things. You can plunder the cities. They took the city and its king and its villages and put them to the sword. Everyone in it was totally destroyed. They left no survivors. They did to Debir and its king as they had done to Libna and its king and to Hebron. And Debir was right here by Hebron. It's been excavated very, very thoroughly in the 1800s. So Joshua subdued the whole region, including the hill country. Now notice the definitions here. The hill country, that would be more on the interior. The Negev, which is to the south. The western foothills, that would be west of the foothills, or west of the hill country, and the mountainous slopes, that would be where Jerusalem and that central ridge, there's a ridge of mountains that run down here. And when we say mountains, we don't mean snow-capped mountains, it means the high rocky part of the land. It's the ridge that runs down the middle. So that identifies the land. He totally destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. Joshua subdued them from Kadesh Barnea, that's in the south there, you can see that on your map, I believe, to Gaza, up here, the Philistine city, and the whole region of Goshen to Gibeon. All the kings and their lands Joshua conquered in one campaign because the Lord, the God of Israel, fought for them. Okay, that's the central, or the entrance, the central campaign, and now we've gone south all the way back down to Kadesh Barnea. That's where they'd been camping, and they turned around and came back. Now, this land up here remains unconquered. Now, I want to look at the map, please. It's the second map now, or excuse me, the second page. And these are, you can look at the map when we start reading through this, but Joshua is going to march from Gilgal or Sechem, wherever their base is at, and they're probably now, they used to be located at Gilgal, but now they've conquered this land. There's probably different stations, there's probably different bases, forts, if you would, set up. And a main headquarters, I'm not sure where it's at. I'm not sure if the text says it or if you can figure it out. It could be Sechem. Maybe it's still at Gilgal. They maybe moved to a different location. But they're going to now move north. And you see that arrow on that third map. It's Joshua 11, where it says Joshua's northern campaign. You can see the line going north, and then you can see the cities there. There's one there, it's called Kinnereth, and it's right on the north shore, northwest shore of Galilee, that used to be called the Sea of Kinnereth. The city of Madon is mentioned, Shimron, there's Megiddo, Dor, and Taanach. And Taanach and Megiddo are two important, and Dor, all those, Megiddo, Taanach, and Dor are all cities that have routes running through them or by them as you move through what is called into the Megiddo Valley. Now, this is the Megiddo Valley right here, the Valley of Armageddon. It's a plain. It's the breadbasket. Right here, a lot of fertile soil there. In fact, the Air Force Base is located there. This is Mount Carmel, a very high mountain. You know the story about Mount Carmel. When you stand on Mount Carmel, you can see all the way down here towards Megiddo. You can see Nazareth. Nazareth is located right here. Remember, this is a plain, so this is flat. This starts rolling into hills down here. It's a huge plain, then starts quickly, rises up, and you've got a ridge with Nazareth on the top, and now you get into the hill country or the mountainous area here towards the north. I've got this a little bit high. It's down here a little bit lower. I've got too high. It's not here. I'll move Galilee. That'll be easier. There we go. It's a little bit closer. Okay. But on Mount Carmel, now what I'm saying here is, here's Mount Carmel. There's a mountainous range right here on the coast, and then it rolls down into foothills, and it's very difficult passing through here. And there's three passes that go through into the Megiddo Valley. So if you can control those three passes, there's no way you can move from the south into the north without going through those three passes and getting into Megiddo. And the pharaohs used that. This is where Josiah, the king, was killed. He's coming up through one of these passes. He gets killed. Hundreds of battles. If you have a copy of the Israel Field Book or other place I've got, you can find it different places. I've got the maps drawn on there, the different routes that run through there. But you can see this map, I guess the reason I'm saying that is a map that I've drawn for you. It's just a flat map with some dots on it. Those dots are all very strategically located, and that's where they're going to be moving into. And so when you get up into this area, they're eventually going to have iron chariots up in here because they can run them in the plains. They're not very useful. You don't hear a lot about chariots down in here because you're in the hill country or you're on the mountainous rocky ridges and they don't have interstates. And if you did, all you could do is run them back and forth on the interstate. You can't fight battles. But once you get up in here, you've got access to this nice plain, and you can still see it today. Hundreds and hundreds of battles have been fought there. Napoleon fought there. Anyone that's fought in the Middle East has fought in the Valley of Megiddo. But anyway, that's where we're heading now, the northern campaign. So let's read through this chapter 11, please. In here, we're going to read about Hazor. H-A-Z-O-R. Hazor is going to say the king of all these cities is Hazor. Hazor is the greatest city. The guy's name, and I just put something on Facebook before I came on my page, my personal page, some photos from Hazor when we were there a couple years ago. And we had a chance to talk to a guy named Amnon Ben-Tor. And he is from the Hebrew University. He is a great archaeologist, one of the legendary archaeologists, and he has been working at Hazor for quite a while. And we just had a chance. We just happened to be there, and he spoke to us for a while. That's when the snake came out and crawled around on the ground, and Larry went running away. You know. Not even Amnon Ben-Tor. Yeah, Tony was leaving. But Amnon Ben-Tor, even he was talking to us, and a snake came crawling right through us. And Amnon Ben-Tor even kind of, what's that? It was a viper, right. It freaked everybody. Even Amnon Ben-Tor, he stomped on it, kicked it down into the pit where everybody was working. Yeah, it crawled over my foot while I videotaped. And it got down in the pit, and then he started, kill it, kill it! You know, interrupted our little class session there. And they didn't want it crunched, so they all had theirs, and they beat it with their shovels and killed it. Yeah, I did post the video. Okay, but anyway, Amnon Ben-Tor, he is... He believes the Bible. He's a great archaeologist. He believes the Bible, literally uses it as information. And he is finding things here that confirm what we're about to read. And I've got some. I haven't put the pictures online like I should have since we got back. I put some videos online. I got wrapped up in reps and sets, so I've still got a bunch of pictures I want to process from 2012. But I did put like 9 of them up there. And on those pictures, you can see the palace of the Canaanite kings. And you can see the burn level, where it was burnt. They say when you go into it, the place got extremely hot. Now remember, what we look at it, we just see rocks or stones that were cut and the remains. But they would have built their palace out of stone, mud bricks possibly. They would have paneled it in wood and carved it. So it would have been a beautiful wooden palace. And the thing that happened there that they discovered was they collected oil in there. You know, vats of oil for cooking, for, you know, body ointment or whatever. They just collected oil. Sometimes for the offerings to the gods, oil was used. So there was vats of oil, large amounts of oil in there, combined with the wood panel. The whole place was paneled in wood, including the floor and all. And when Joshua came in, apparently, someone came in and smashed all the statues. The statues of their gods and their kings were just in tiny pieces. They had to put them back together and find out what they were. And the place was burnt extremely hot. It got so hot in there, and they say the reason it got so hot was because of the wood, the fire, mixed with the oil, took the temperature to a very high level that it glazed the bricks. The mud bricks were glazed. And so it was like a kiln in there. And so someone says it's going to say, and they burnt Hazor, they burnt it. And they've got it layered. There's a couple destruction layers. And one of the destruction layers appears to come from the pharaohs. Egypt appears to have destroyed Hazor. But there's a destruction layer that matches this perfectly. And all the gods and all the images were destroyed. There's an altar out in front of the palace that we can still see. There's a cultic center by the gate coming in where they had, when the people would come into the city, they'd offer their sacrifice to the gods and then enter into the city and go up to the higher place on Hazor. But anyway, Hazor is there, and Amnon Ben-Tor has been the archaeologist that's been working on that. And the thing that he was talking to us about that he's looking for, and he gave us several reasons why Hazor was a great city, because it's referred to in some of the letters, those Armana letters we're talking about. Hazor is referred to it. What they have not found and what Amnon Ben-Tor wants to find is the archive in Hazor, because they find letters from Hazor in Egypt. They find letters from Hazor out east in Babylon or Chaldea, but they haven't found any letters from Chaldea or Egypt in Hazor. They found some inscriptions. They found some cuneiform writing, some small fragments, but they haven't found what they find in other major cities, and that's the royal archive, where they just have the library of all their documentation. And he's looking for it. He's thought he was close a couple times, tried to guess where it was going to be, but they haven't found it. And again, once they find that, and they can translate or decipher cuneiform writing, they'll be able to add to a lot of the history that we already know. Anyway, here we go. They're going to move north, up through the Megiddo Valley, up through one of these passes, through the Megiddo Valley, meet the Canaanites, and fight their way until they get to Hazor. And Hazor is going to be the capital. We always think of Jericho as the major city. And Jericho, it was a major city, except it really is down here. It's kind of protecting that border. If we want to say Jericho is more like a fort, protecting an attack from the west or the east. And they took Jericho. But Hazor would be that's where the king lived. That's where coming from the north. They're right there on the northern pass coming into the land. So Hazor was a major city. And so here we go. When Jabin, here it is, king of Hazor, heard of this, he sent word to Jobab, king of Madon. You can see all these are now going to be mentioned on the map there. To the kings of Shimron and Akshath, and to the northern kings who were in the mountains. Now again, I've got Mount Hermon drawn right here. So north of Hazor is Mount Hermon. South of Kinnereth, which is south of Galilee, Sea of Galilee. In the western foothills, in Nathoth Dor, and there's Dor over in here. And to the west, to the Canaanites in the east and west, to the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, the Jebusites, the hill country, and to the Hivites below Hermon, living at the base of Mount Hermon. So this is the last stand. They've lost the fortress. They've lost the central territory, including Jerusalem. They've lost the south. And Israel now turns, they regroup, have some lunch, and head north. And the king of Hazor now says, uh-oh, they're coming after us now. They came out with all their troops and a large number of horses and chariots. Now all of a sudden you hear about chariots. You don't hear about chariots down here, not as useful. But up here, they've got chariots. A huge army as numerous as the sand on the seashore. All these kings joined forces and made camp together at the waters of Merom. The waters of Merom are right here. They're near the Sea of Galilee. To fight against Israel. But the Lord said to Joshua, do not be afraid of them, because by this time tomorrow, I will hand all of them over to Israel, slain. You are to hamstring their horses and burn their chariots. In other words, rip the engines out and burn the chariots. In other words, you hamstring the horse, they're useless. They can no longer be used to pull chariots. So ruin their military. So Joshua and his whole army came against them suddenly at the waters of Merom and attacked them, and the Lord gave them into the hand of Israel. So they meet, all these kings came together, united a front, and Joshua was right up and meets them. They defeated them and pursued them all the way to Greater Sidon. Sidon is over this way. It's up one of the Phoenician cities. To Mizrephoth, Maim, and to the valley of Mizpah on the east until no survivors were left. Joshua did to them as the Lord had directed. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots. Another translation, possibly in the Hebrew, is chopped up. Instead of just hamstringing them, it could be translated chop them up. Meaning just ruin them. Doesn't want anybody to use them. This would be now the second phase of the battle. At that time, Joshua turned back and captured Hazor, which was about 200 acres at that time. Hazor of Joshua's time that's been excavated by Amon Ben-Tor is about 200 acres. And put its king to the sword. Hazor had been the head of these kingdoms. And Amon Ben-Tor quoted that verse to us when we were there. He says, Hazor was a great city. He says, it was more important than any of these other cities. And he gave several reasons, because we find him in letters, correspondence from other countries at this time, for this reason or that reason. Then he says, if you believe the Bible, he says, the Bible says it was the greatest of all those cities. And he kind of says, there you have it. If you believe the Bible, there you have it. It was the greatest. So history proves, archaeology shows, the Bible records, and Amon Ben-Tor says so, that this was the greatest of the cities. And here it is in the Bible. Hazor had been the head of these kingdoms. Everyone in it they put to the sword. They totally destroyed them, not sparing anything that breathed, and burned up Hazor itself. And there you have it, and they can see the remains of those that burning. Joshua took all these royal cities and their kings and put them to the sword. He totally destroyed them as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. Yet Israel did not burn any of the cities built on their mounds except Hazor. And that's an important statement. You don't find burn layers through all of these. You see destruction layers, but they weren't burned because Israel did what? They moved into them. But Hazor was the capital. It was the head. It had to be completely leveled. So there's the headquarters was gone. The archive was lost. We're still looking for it. So Joshua took the entire land, verse 16, the hill country, and now remember, these all can be identified, the hill country, all the Negev, the whole region of Goshen, over here, the western foothills, the Araba, that's the center part right here, the Jordan Valley, and the mountains of Israel with their foothills, from Mount Halek, which rises towards Seir, Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon, these are up north, below Mount Hermon. He captured all their kings and struck them down, putting them to death. Joshua waged war against all these kings for a long time, except for the Hivites living in Gibeon. Not one city made a treaty of peace with Israel, who took them in battle. For it was the Lord himself who hardened their hearts to wage war against Israel so that he might destroy them, totally exterminating them without mercy. Now there is an interesting line right there. The Lord totally exterminated. The Lord hardened their hearts so he could totally exterminate them without mercy, as the Lord had commanded Moses. Verse 21, at that time Joshua went and destroyed the Anakites. Now this is an interesting deal, so they just throw this in there and you do what you want to with it. But now he's going to turn back, he's going to go back down to Hebron. At that time, Joshua went and destroyed the Anakites, and these could possibly be one of those references to the descendants of Anak, which are those large people. They weren't Canaanites. They were another race of people. Though some would call them the giants. I'm just throwing this out there so you know it's here. From the hill country, from Hebron to Debir to Anab, from all the hill country of Judah, and from all the hill country of Israel, Joshua totally destroyed them with their swords. No Anakites were left. Watch this. Are you ready? No Anakites were left in Israelite territory, but where'd they go? Only in Gaza, Gath, Ashdod did any survive. And now when's the next time you pick up the giants? Coming out of where? Goliath of Gath. In other words, Joshua came down here and destroyed this race, and Goliath was a descendant of Anak. He moved over here. Joshua came down and destroyed them. And they were destroyed, or they fled over into the Gaza Strip, the Philistine territory, and tells you exactly where they lived. And it appears that Goliath, again, this is it's a pretty solid idea, but there seems to be five of them left of this, the descendants of Anak. They didn't continue all the way through history, but by David's time, there seems to be Goliath and then his four brothers. You've heard that talked about before. That's why David picked up the five stones, not in case he had missed, but because later on, the book of 1 Samuel then records those four other guys being killed. There was five of these Anak descendants left. No Anakites were left in Israel territory. Only in Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod did any survive. So Joshua took the entire land, just as the Lord had directed Moses, and he gave it as an inheritance to Israel according to their tribal divisions. Then the land had rest from war. Now remember that right there. The land had rest from war. Now, when we get going here, we're going to end up having, we're heading towards the division of the land, and I want to move through that. But in chapter 12, just as a list of the defeated kings, these are the kings of the land whom the Israelites had defeated, whose territory they took over in the east of Jordan from Arnon. So this includes all, this is the total list of kings, from Moses' battles on the east side to Joshua's battles on the west up into the north. It gives you a list of all the kings, and you can see there they are. They're all just put on there right there. We could read more about it, but you've got the list. Chapter 13. The land still needed to be taken. When Joshua was old and well advanced in years, the Lord said to him, "You are very old, and there are still very large areas of land to be taken over." So that's an important thing. One of the things the Lord is going to say as we read through here, He took the land, but remember, he warned them, I'm not going to give it to you all at once, because otherwise you won't be able to manage the land and wild animals will take over and you'll have problems managing, which is an interesting look. I mean, we live in a culture, a generation, a time in history where if man would just disappear from the earth would flourish and butterflies would fly and rainbows would be out and we'd get rid of all bad weather. It'd always be a perfect day out, because that's the way the world is. It's like, according to from Genesis through the Bible, we need to be good stewards of the earth, but the earth is designed to have man in it managing it. You understand what I'm saying? Now, this, you're not going to hear this in your local political speech, okay? But the earth is designed by God, you can read in Genesis, to be managed by man. And man can abuse his management privileges, which doesn't mean we shouldn't trash the earth. But if you just removed man from the earth and everything would go back to being perfect, it's like, you know, it would be overrun with other types of chaos. Chaos is a force in the earth. And God tells them, if I gave you the land all at once, you wouldn't be able to manage it. I'm going to have to use some of these Canaanites to kind of manage the fringes of the land until you are ready to take over. And part of it's going to be also, he's going to say, for war experience. He did there's generations that was going to come that did not have previous battle experience. And so God is going to use them to help keep them as a military operation. You understand what I'm saying? It's not Joshua kills everybody and then the next generation just live in peace and have no conflicts. God wanted them to have conflict so they could be sharp at war and be have a military base, but also to use the other Canaanites to help manage the land. So, nonetheless, we are in chapter 13, verse 1. You are old, God says to Joshua, and there are still very large areas of land to be taken over. This is the land that remains. All the region of the Philistines, okay, the Geshurites, from the Shihor River on the east of Egypt to the territory of Ekron on the north, all the country of the Canaanites. Now, if you're going to want to look at these maps right here. I'm on the fourth map on the second page, and that's Joshua returns to drive out the giants. Okay, I just went ahead and named it right there. You can see Ashdod, Gath, and Gaza, where they fled to. And then Hebron, Debir, and Anab, where they were at in the hill country of Judah. Okay, that's them fleeing. Now we go to the next map. Josh, this is the land, the unconquered land. The next two maps are the unconquered land. And what we just talked about is the foothills, the hill country. Those were conquered. And the Negev. But what wasn't conquered is going to be on this next page. You can see the Girgashites to the south, the Philistines and some Canaanites and Sidonianites, Amorites along the coastal plain, going all the way in. And that, this is the definition of what we just read, goes up to Lebo Hamath. You see where Lebo Hamath is? It's up there by Damascus and goes all the way to the Euphrates River. There's a land that is charted out there that is mentioned here that God says, I haven't given you this land yet. And that was land that is promised to Abraham. It's also promised and mentioned to David and Solomon. Just so you can see, that's where we're talking about right there. Turn the page. I should have numbered these pages. What's that? Current Israel would go up to, let's just say, Mount Hermon. Yeah, you can see on there, Mount Hermon. Because right there, Mount Hermon, you're right on the border of Lebanon. And to the west or east of Mount Hermon, you're now in, that's Jordan. I mean, you can come out, you can stay on the east side of the Sea of Galilee, but you go too far from the east side of the Sea of Galilee and you're looking into the land of Jordan. So Mount Hermon coming south, and then of course you got the Sinai Peninsula, you know, the battle of the war of 67, 73, different things took place there. They come down into the Negev there. They control all the way to the coast, except for the Gaza Strip, probably right there on the where it says, it says Philistines, I've got it written out there, probably where the I-N-E-S or T-I-N-E-S, that's the Gaza Strip right now. They don't have that. And then they've got part of the West Bank, which is kind of where Jericho is at, coming down, and it's not marked on this map, but Jericho swings over into Bethlehem, going down into Hebron. That part is part of the West Bank. Now, you can get into Jericho, you can get into today, you can get into Bethlehem, you got to go through checkpoints. But usually when you get down towards Hebron, it's pretty heated up. That's where the territory is at today in a rough sense. Okay, turn to the page if you want to. And now I've got it says unconquered land, and it says Joshua 13, 1 through 7. It's a pencil drawing, and that gives you more definitions. And then the next map is going to be Joshua 13, 14, and 15, called the division of the land. So you can kind of look at those. That's what I'm going to be referring to. Look on that map on the right that says division of the land. Is everybody kind of know where I'm at? Is this okay? Okay, I didn't number these. I should have numbered them. But what we're going to see, look at where it says Judah, right there in the territory of Judah, and then go up to that dotted line to the north of Judah, and you can see where I've got a little dotted line there. And these places like Jabneel on the left and coming over to Mount Balas, and then Ekron, and those are all mentioned in Scripture. That's where I drew. Now, this is not an archaeological map. This is something I just copied off other maps and put dots in. Sometimes they say, we don't know where this place is at. And I'd say, well, it must be right about here. And I'd put a dot. Okay, I'm just kind of, making it, because the dot's not going to be clear up off the map. It's going to probably be between those other two dots. So I kind of made this just kind of get a feel for what was being said. But they're going to read through that list. They're going to give you, encircle Judah. They're going to give you the borders of Reuben. They're going to give you the borders of Gad. That's going to be in chapter 13, 14, 15. It's not exciting reading. It's not, sometimes there are little stories are in there. But what it does, it's almost like a legal document. It's a land grant of where they are at. Now, look at the land of Judah on that map, on the second map on that page. And notice the land of the Philistines is in the land of Judah. But they never, the Philistines are going to be there for a long time until the Babylonians destroy them. They're never going to get rid of them. They're never going to take all the land to the coast, okay? There's going to be times they defeat the Philistines. So there's always going to be situations there. This is the land they were given that they are responsible for, but they didn't always take possession of their whole land, or did they use their land the way they were supposed to? Okay, so I'm going to go back to, you can use that map as a reference. I'm going to go back to chapter 13, verse 6. As for all the inhabitants of the mountain regions from Lebanon to Mezrephoth, Maim, that is, all the Sidonians, that's the land we call Lebanon or Phoenicia, I myself will drive them out before the Israelites. Be sure to allocate this land to Israel for an inheritance as I have instructed you, and divide it as an inheritance among the between the nine tribes and half a tribe of Manasseh. Now they say nine tribes because remember, half of Manasseh is over here. Gad and Reuben are still over here. They settled on the east side. They've been fighting the battles, but they're going to be marching home here real soon. Division of the land to these, verse 8. The other half of Manasseh, the Reubenites, the Gadites, had received an inheritance that Moses had given them to the east. I guess I just said that. And then he gives verses 9 through 13, describes the description of the land on the east side. Verse 14, but to the tribe of Levi he gave no inheritance. Okay, that's why it only says 9.5, and then 10, 11, 12. What happened to the tribe of Levi? Well, Levi doesn't get any because their portion is the tabernacle, their portion is the Lord's portion, and they'll live off the tithes. Now, they will have Levitical cities. We'll talk about that here in a moment. Verse 15, this is what Moses had given to the tribe of Reuben, clan by clan. And there again, the territory from Aroer to the rim of the Arnon Gorge. And that's verses 16 going through verse 23. Balaam's mentioned in that section. Verse 24 of chapter 13 talks about Gad's territory. Verse 29 begins describing Manasseh's territory. You can kind of see what I did with the map. I just read through and made little dots on it. This is the inheritance Moses had given in verse 32 when he was in the plains of Moab across the Jordan east of Jericho. But to the tribe of Levi, Moses had given no inheritance. Chapter 14. Now these are the areas the Israelites received as an inheritance in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest, Joshua son of Nun, and the heads of the tribal clans of Israel allotted to them. So notice who the leadership is now. You're going to have your tribal leaders from each of the tribes, but you've also got Joshua, who's the general, serving kind of in Moses' position, not like a king, more like a general, but more like a prophet in Moses. You know what I'm saying? He's a king, he's a prophet, he's a general. What is he? Moses was a prophet operating as a general. None of these guys are kings, but they're kind of assuming the responsibility of a king, either as a general or in the role of a prophet. And that's kind of what Joshua is. And then, of course, Eleazar, the priest. So this would be Aaron's son, Eleazar, who's now taken over. Verse 2, chapter 14, verse 2. Their inheritance was assigned to them by tribe to the 9.5 tribes as the Lord had commanded through Moses. That'd be Deuteronomy chapter 33. Moses had granted the 2.5 tribes to the east. We know that. Then it goes on and says, let's go to verse 6 of chapter 14. Now the men of Judah approached Joshua at Gilgal. Now there, where's Joshua at? He said, now that might give us a clue. Where is that? Has that remained the main base of Joshua's operation? It would appear that he's gone back there, that maybe during this whole campaign, that was where the base never... Some people want to say they moved to Sethra, they moved somewhere else. But right here, is it Gilgal? I always like to say Gilgal, but that's the best we can do. And Caleb's son, they approached Joshua, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenite, said to him. So now remember, Caleb and Joshua, they're old men now. They were the original spies that came in with the 12, where they reported back to Moses. Joshua has become the leader. You haven't heard much about Caleb, but Caleb's been fighting alongside of him this whole time. And Joshua's from the tribe of Judah. So Caleb is from the tribe of Judah. He now approaches his buddy, his friend, they grew up together, Joshua, who's now the general. He approaches him on behalf of his tribe of Judah to talk about his inheritance. He says, you know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, at Kadesh Barnea. That's down south here where the spies reported back. About you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to explore the land. You know I'm talking about the 12 spies. And this, Caleb was one of them. And I brought him back a report according to my convictions. But my brothers who went up with me made the hearts of the people melt with fear. So it was his convictions and it was God's will. But the bad report swayed public opinion against him. I, however, follow the Lord my God wholeheartedly. So on that day, Moses swore to me. He quotes Moses. This is 40 years later now, or maybe even 45 years later, because they've been in the land possibly for 5 years. This didn't happen in just, you know, 3 afternoons. Okay, this has been probably a 5-year process of taking the land, apparently. And so now about 45 years later, he's been hanging on to this promise of Moses for 45 years. He says, Moses said, swore to me, the land on which your feet have walked will be your inheritance and that of your children forever because you have followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. Now then, just as the Lord promised, he has kept me alive for 45 years since that time he said this to Moses while Israel moved about in the desert. So here I am today, 85 years old. I am still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. I'm just as vigorous to go out in battle now as I was then. That's pretty cool. I feel like I'm 40 years old. Okay? Now, for us that are older than 40, that sounds pretty good. If you're under 40, it doesn't sound like very promising. Verse 12. Now, give me this hill country that the Lord promised me that day. You yourselves heard then that the Anakites were there, and their cities were large and fortified. But with the Lord helping me, I will drive them out just as he said. So I'm going to do what we should have done 45 years ago. Give me this allotted inheritance. I'm going to go out and fight like I'm 40 years old. Then Joshua blessed Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and gave him Hebron as his inheritance. So that the city of Hebron becomes Caleb's city. So Hebron belonged to Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, ever since, because he followed the Lord, the God of Israel, wholeheartedly. Hebron used to be called Kiriath Arba, after Arba, who was the greatest man among the Anakites. Now that should spark an interest. Arba was the greatest of the Anakites, and the Anakites may have been the giants, and Arba would be the greatest of the giants, and so it was called Kiriath Arba after one of the great giants, if you follow that line of thought. Okay, chapter 15, the allotment. So now Caleb's down here in Hebron, and they're getting ready to go to battle. He's not going to go sit on the porch and swing. He's going to go get his sword resharpened and go back to battle. The allotment, chapter 15, verse 1, the allotment for the tribe of Judah, clan by clan, extended down to the territory of Edom. That's down here, of course. The desert of Zin in the extreme country. And that's where Israel spent some time in the desert of Zin. And you've got the boundaries. Verse 2 going up to verse 12. And that's on your sheet. That's where I got all those little dots from. Those are all the different cities, which would be extremely ridiculous to read those to you. So I just made a map and showed them to you. These are the boundaries around the people of Judah and their clan. Verse 13. In accordance with the Lord's command to him, Joshua gave to Caleb, son of Jephunneh, a portion in Judah, Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron. Arba was the father of Anak. From Hebron, Caleb drove out from the 3 Anakites, there's their names, Sheshiah, Ahiman, and Telmi, descendants of Anak. He drives those 3 out, and we know where he drives them, over to the land of the Philistines. From there, he marched against the people living in Debir, formerly called Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb says, I will give my daughter Aksa in marriage to the man who attacks and captures Kiriath Sefer. So in other words, he says, hey, who wants to take the city? You can marry my daughter. It's like, Dad, what? What are you doing, Dad? But no, he'd be a hero. That was part of their culture. Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's brother, took it. So Caleb gave his daughter Aksa to him in marriage. Now, remember that name, Othniel? It's going to pop up in the book of Judges. Othniel is going to be very active in the book of Judges at the very beginning. One day when she came to Othniel, she urged him to ask her father for a field. She got off her donkey. Caleb asked her, what can I do for you? She replied, do me a special favor. Since you have given me land in the Negev, give me also the springs of water. You gave me land, but I want a water source. So Caleb gave her the upper and lower springs. And of course, now that's kind of like a document of who owns the land. This is the inheritance of the tribe of Judah. And then it goes through and gives you a list of who's living where and their places. All it gives you hill country in verse 48, verse 61 in the desert. Because that circle of Judah includes the Negev, it includes the hill country, it includes some of the foothills, it includes a mountainous ridge there with Jerusalem. It goes all the way over to the Dead Sea. It includes the springs of En Gedi. So, I mean, there's a lot of different land in Judah, a wide range of land, including, we'll look in chapter 15, verse 61. In the desert, they also had Beth Arba, Midden, Sekeka, Nibsan, and right here, the city of salt and En Gedi, six towns and their villages. So right there, the city of salt may be the city of Qumran. If you know the Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls, Qumran, we were there looking at the caves and stuff. That would be, City of Salt would be, could be Qumran. And then En Gedi, that's where we went swimming. We got pictures of us in the waterfall and stuff like that. That's where David was hiding. Sixth town of their village. Judah could not dislodge the Jebusites. Now, this is important. Verse 63 is important. One thing they could not do, they could not dislodge the Jebusites who were living where? In Jerusalem. To this day, the Jebusites live there with the people of Judah. Is that not interesting? Talk about editing. That's a portion that wasn't edited. It says to this day, whenever this was put together, this wasn't edited by them coming back from after in Babylonian exile in 400 or 500 BC. Because they says in that day, we hadn't even taken Jerusalem yet. The Jebusites still live among us here in Judah. That's when this was written. So this was written and put together, this book, when the Jebusites were still living there, if you accept the literal interpretation of this right here. Now, it does appear, if you want to put some more stories together, it does appear that Jerusalem was attacked and destroyed and even burnt, but the Jebusites held their territory, came back and rebuilt, and they're still there. So there was a time where they came in and destroyed the city. It talks about it being burnt, but they never took the city. They're not going to take the city until probably about 250 years later in the days of David, they'll take Jerusalem. So there's the city of Jerusalem right there. Chapter 16, allotment for Ephraim and Manasseh. And basically what you've got there, chapter, it's just like that. You've got verses 1 through 3, the allotment for Joseph. And verse 4, Manasseh and Ephraim, the descendants of Joseph, received their inheritance. Verse 5 talks about Ephraim. Chapter 17 begins talking about the tribe of Manasseh. If you look over it, you get some storyline right here in verse 14, chapter 17, verse 14. Oh, let's go to verse, I'm sorry, I'm just kind of randomly grabbing verses here. Look in chapter 16, verse 10. It says, they did not dislodge the Canaanites living in Gezer. Remember Gezer? When's Gezer going to be taken? They defeated the king there, but they never got rid of the Canaanites there. Who's going to do that? It's going to be Pharaoh in Solomon's day is going to come up and burn Gezer to the ground and give it to Solomon or give it to his daughter for Solomon to rebuild. And that's right here. They did not dislodge the Canaanites living in Gezer. To this day, the Canaanites live among the people of Ephraim, but are required to do forced labor. They let them live there in Gezer. They couldn't take their city. But Pharaoh is going to come up and burn the city. And that burn layer is there. You can see the burn layer. Gives it to Solomon, who then comes over and rebuilds the city and builds the gates that you can also see. That's the city of Gezer right there. Look in verse 14 of chapter 17. The people of Joseph said to Joshua, why have you given us only one allotment and one portion for an inheritance? We are a numerous people, meaning Joshua was his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. It's too small for us. What you gave us is not enough room for Ephraim and Manasseh. We need more room. If you are so numerous, Joshua says in verse 15, And if the hill country of Ephraim is too small for you, go up into the forest and clear the land for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and the Rephaites. In other words, you want more land? Go get it. It's like, you can have it, but I'm not going to give it to you. Go clear it. Meaning, clear the forest doesn't mean chop down the trees. It means clear out the people, and then you can have the land. Now, what's interesting, I got a great set of archaeological books. There's five-volume sets, about five of them all like this, and it talks about all kinds of little details of archaeology. And right before I came out, and I looked this verse up, and it says right here at this time, this is not junk science. This, sometimes you read stuff on the internet or something, weird stuff. This is the scholars writing from universities, from archaeological projects. But in that area, in this area of the Ephraim and the hill country right in here, at this time, actually, right at the same time, right around 1200 BC, about the same time that Caleb or Joshua would be saying, or these things would be taking place, or it had been released that you could go do this, they had to go. I mean, it didn't happen in a day. They had to go out and fight the battles, clear the land. But at that time, right around 1200 BC, 300 Israelite villages pop up right there, almost instantaneously at the same time. And they know they're Israelite villages because, well, what kind of thing? What don't they find there? They don't find the remains of pig bones. They find Israelite pottery or potsherds that match the style of pottery that the Israelites were using. And there's different things they realize. And it matches this right here. Just another interesting thing right there. And so they did that. But Joshua said to the house of Joshua. Okay, verse 18. The whole assembly of Israelites gathered at Shiloh and set up the tent of meeting there. And this is where it's going to be up until the days of Samuel. Shiloh is going to be right in this area here. It's Gilgal Sechem. Right in this area is going to be Shiloh. And we were there. And they're excavating it. And what they find out there at Shiloh, it was not a residential city. It was the remains there are not the remains of a city. You don't find the same, the layers of... They find a lot of ceremonial things there. So it matches the description of Shiloh, where the tabernacle was. They don't find the tabernacle again was a temporary structure. They may have put a base around it, like a stone base to kind of help stabilize it or something. But as far as being a build, it wasn't a building; it was a tent. So when the Philistines come in and destroy it in the days of Samuel, it's gone. There's nothing left, and so it's hard to find the tabernacle. But these descriptions do match right here in Shiloh. Nonetheless, the country was brought under their control, but there were still seven Israelite tribes who had not received their inheritance at this time, and the tabernacles had been set up. So Joshua said to the Israelites, "How long will you wait before you begin to take possession of the land the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you?" Now, isn't that something? We're not sure how many years this has been now, but it's been long enough that some of the Israelites are just kind of living in little groups somewhere. Maybe they're still living in the land of Judah with the people of Judah. Since the people of Judah thought, well, we'll move down there and live. And Joshua calls them together after they have some kind of a ceremony here at Shiloh, the tabernacle set up, says, "You guys still don't have homes? What are you waiting for? Get out there and take the land." It's like, well, we're tired of fighting. We want to do this. It's like, there's no government program for you. Go out and take the land. He says, "How long are you going to wait? The Lord has given it to you. How long is it?" Man, you can just hear a sermon coming on right there, can't you? It's like, the Lord has given it to you. How long are you going to stand here and wait? We're waiting for the Lord. Now, I'm going to jump ahead to the book of Joshua. And that's when the Lord comes and sits down under a tree and starts talking to Gideon and says, "Go do this, Gideon." He says, "Well, I can't. The Lord's not with us." He says, "Go in the strength you have." He says, "I'm not going to do anything. I've already done everything." The Lord comes and visits him, the angel of the Lord, and sits down. He's not fighting. He just sits down and says, "You go." And Gideon says, "Well, the Lord's not with us." It's like, the Lord is still with you. He's done. The problem is, he's done everything he's going to do. He got you to the land. He's given you this, and he gave you the promises. He gave you the word. He gave you the assignment. Everything's there. It's all in his plan. The Lord's way. The next thing to do is the Lord is going to break his own word. In other words, if the Lord does anything more, he's going to do more than what he said he was going to do. He's going to end up fighting the battle that you're supposed to fight. So there's that balance. And really, even in our lives, there's that balance. The Lord will do the work. Unless the Lord builds the house, labors labor in vain. But notice, the laborers are still doing what? Laboring. You understand the idea there? Unless the Lord builds the house, well, I'm just going to sit and let the Lord do it. It's like, no, that's not the message. It's never been the message. The message is the Lord will do his part, give you the word, give you the promise, give you the assignment, and then what's left? You go, well, why is nothing happening? Why is the Lord not moving? Because the Lord's done moving. It's your turn to move. That's where Gideon, when Joshua sees the angel of the Lord, has got what? He's got a drawn sword. He's going to battle. He's on his feet. I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. When Gideon sees the angel of the Lord, what's he doing? He's sitting underneath a tree. I think he's drinking a Coke. You know, he doesn't say that. I just think that's probably what he's doing. I don't know. But you know, it's a different, completely different image. He's not in, he says, you go do it. I don't know what you're waiting for. Anyway, you just hear Joshua's words right here. How long will you wait? I'm in verse chapter 18, verse 3. How long will you wait before you begin to take possession of the land the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you? Appoint 3 men from each tribe. I will send them out to make a survey of the land and to write a description of it according to the inheritance of each. Then they will return to me. You are to divide the land into 7 parts. Judah is to remain in its territory on the south of the house of Joseph in the north. And we start talking about that. We'll have to pick that up next week. And basically what we're going to do, have to pick up next week right there in verse chapter 18. But if you notice chapter 19, you've got allotments for Simeon, allotments for Zebulun. In other words, what Joshua's going to do right here says, go off and measure the land, find some boundaries so they know what they're fighting. Give them some territory. Give them a playing field. You go conquer this area. You go conquer this area. And bring it back. And they just, all the chapter 19, Asher, Dan, Naphtali, that's all those little slots of land up here in the north. They're on the maps. Chapter 20, if you want to see ahead here, the cities of refuge. You remember what the cities of refuge are? When someone gets into legal trouble, they can go to the city of refuge and stay there and hide and be protected until the court case. And they've got a map that shows you all the little cities of refuge. The towns of the Levites. The Levites are going to be scattered all around. They're not all going to live in Shiloh. The Levites are the teaching tribe. They're the ones who are in charge of the tabernacle, but also the things of the Lord, which includes the word of the Lord and the rituals. So they're going to be scattered throughout Israel in all the tribes. So every tribe has Levitical cities or priestly cities. Call them seminaries, if you would. And that's described in chapter 21. Chapter 22, that's when the tribes in the east go home. Reuben goes home. They go back across. They're done fighting. Chapter 23, Joshua says goodbye. Chapter 24, they go back to Shechem and renew their covenant. And Joshua then dies. Somewhere in there we've got to bury Joseph's bones too. But then Joshua's going to die, and then we're in the book of Judges. So we will finish the book of Joshua next week, I would assume. Thank you for your patience. Again, it's a tough set of verses right there in a sense. You guys just dividing land up. Yes, sir. Yes.
Because today we still have so much trouble coming out of Gaza, and I just wondered if he had ordered them to be totally destroyed and it didn't happen.
They never did take out who ends up destroying the Philistines is Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, all these things that didn't get done here, Nebuchadnezzar finishes them off. So there are no Philistines left today. I mean, they were destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. And what's interesting is, and you know the story too, in Judges, the tribe of Dan was right there by the Philistines. They're supposed to tribe, and they couldn't do it. So they decided, they sent some spies out to go find them. In the book of Judges, it's like a comedy. It's a sad, ironic, sad, but it's funny. It's so bad. You know what I'm saying? They couldn't fight the Philistines, so they find somebody that they could fight. So they send some people up here, and they fight, and they go up here, and they move up here in the land of Dan, up here by Lachish. And they move away from here. So it was too hard for them. They just moved, went somewhere else, got out of God's will and did some ridiculous things. And the book of Judges lets you know, the book of Judges that's coming next, when a group of people walk away from the instructions and the revelation of the Word of God and they start just following their own thoughts, their own philosophies, imitating the world, how ridiculous your religion can become. And it was just a disaster. And then, of course, if it wasn't for a guy like named David and Samuel, some of these guys come along and kind of hold everybody's, you know, I don't know how, you know, fingers to the fire. That's not that good, you know. you've got to get this job done. They kind of make their nation kind of walk in line, brought them back some success. Well, I'm going to pray, and then we are done. How's the weather look, Tony? The same. Drive safe. Drive safe, please. Thank you for coming out on a snowy night. Father, do thank you so much for your truth. We thank you for what you've given to us. We thank you for the encouragement and the direction. We know you're the same God that they served at those days that we serve today. We ask that we would be faithful, that we'd take your word and take your advice and take their examples and apply it to our own situations and live a life that is pleasing to you and live a life that is successful. Again, we thank you so much for these things that you've given to us. And I ask, especially tonight, that we'd have safety on the way home, and ask you'd bless these people for the time they've invested this evening and give them safe travel and protection all the way home. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.